We are talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So starting out with local news, the Seattle Human Rights Commission made a call out this week.
Yeah,
sure did.
Yeah, this week the Seattle Human Rights Commission sent a letter to Mayor Jenny Durkan, and I just wanted to quote from the letter because it says it right up front what the
letter
is about.
And it's a really good letter.
It is, and I recommend people search for it and read it. The quote starts, "Seattle's failure in its commitment to be a human rights city rests in the actions and inaction of our elected leaders. By her actions and selective inaction, Mayor Jenny Durkan has shown us what leadership means to her and what she thinks of the people of Seattle. The negative impact of inaction will take generations to unwind. As representatives for all communities in the city of Seattle, it is our duty to advise and amplify. Thus, the Human Rights Commission for the City of Seattle is seeking the immediate resignation of Mayor Jenny Durkan for willful violation of duty pursuant to Article 5, Section 10 of the Seattle City Charter." And that's the end of the quote. That's pretty much, you know, the first two or three paragraphs of the letter. Now, Article 5 of the City Charter governs the Executive Department. Section 10 is entitled Removal of Mayor, and it spells out how a two-thirds majority of the City Council can remove a mayor from office. And so the letter then goes on to lay out the grounds for why they think Jenny Durkan should resign, or the City Council should dismiss her. And first off, they talk about police brutality. Mayor Durkan has repeatedly, this is another quote from the letter, "Mayor Durkan has repeatedly authorized the use of police violence and tools of military force against peaceful demonstrators, civilian bystanders, legal observers, and members of the media," end quote.
I would add medics to that, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. And then they go on to say that she's allowed the use of chemical weapons in densely populated neighborhoods, which is true, in spite of the fact that she initially banned the police from using tear gas for 30 days back in early June and then didn't do anything when the Seattle Police Department outright violated her order. Okay.
Yeah, and then continued to do it after the 30 days expired.
Yeah, as if she didn't exist at all. The second thing that they accuse her of is, and this is another direct quote, "Mayor Durkan has failed to adequately address Seattle's growing homelessness crisis," end quote. And then they go on to point out that most of Seattle's homeless are people of color, a high percentage are LGBTQ youth, are disabled, have mental health issues, or are victims of domestic violence. And the Seattle Human Rights Commission really say in their letter that they are tasked with speaking on behalf of people in that demographic. And so it was morally incumbent on them to write this letter. They also talk about income inequality, that while the City Council has been attempting to address economic disparity by raising more revenue for the city to spend money where it's needed most, Mayor Durkan continues to veto one bill after another that the City Council passes while providing no replacement plan for not justifying her vetoes and for not showing any kind of empathy or understanding that there are people who are in desperate need of assistance by the city. And then finally, they say that she has failed to lead the city. Durkan vetoed the 2020 revised budget, including desperately needed funds for COVID-19 relief that the City Council worked hard to craft. And that by continuing to veto these important bills, she's undermined the City Council's ability to govern. And I think that's reflected in the polls that tend to blame the City Council for all the city's ills, when in fact the mayor is playing a very significant part in that problem. So as a consequence, they call on Mayor Durkan to resign. And if she does not, they ask the City Council to, quote, begin removal proceedings for willful violation of duty, end quote. And I think it's really a breathtaking document, this letter.
I concur.
Yeah. And so I know a number of you might be asking, you know, what is the Human Rights Commission? You know, is it a new body? Or, you know, who are, they a bunch of activists, self-appointed activists? Well, actually, the Seattle Human Rights Commission was created in 1963. So it's been around for 57 years. And its task is to advise the mayor, city council, and other city departments on human rights issues. There are 21 positions on the commission, but the mayor and the city council, although city council has appointed a number of the people who currently sit on the body, it's got a lot of vacant seats. And the mayor has only appointed, I believe, one or two people who are sitting on the commission at this point, although she has the power to appoint 8 positions on the commission. The city council can appoint 8, and 4 are appointed by the commission itself. One member joins through a youth leadership program called Get Engaged for people between ages 18 and 29. And that's the Human Rights Commission.
And I would point out the timing of this is important. I think they were waiting until Durkin proposed her budget. She has tried to reduce the budget of the Human Rights Commission, as did Ed Murray before her. Mm-hmm. And I think they were fearing retaliation if they issued this call before she gave her proposed budget to city council, which was last week.
Well, I think one of the things that the Human Rights Commission struggles with is getting the number of people on the commission up to what it should be, because the commission right now, I think, is about half of what the number of people sitting on the commission are about half of what it should be. And it's hard when the mayor is continually trying to cut the money you have to work with, you know, to get people
absolutely.
To volunteer.
And this has been a pattern with Durkin. She's underfunded them. She's underfunded the race and social justice equity positions in the city. Anything like that, she has really tried to shortchange and funnel the money to her preferred programs.
Yeah, and I'm thinking in particular about one part of the city government that she didn't underfund, and that's the navigation team, which went for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, right, without doing...
Incredibly destructive.
Incredibly destructive, and without doing any kind of racial or social justice equity work that they were required to do by the city council. They just would release a report every quarter. You know, Lisa Herbold would pass a bill with every budget saying you have to send reports to the city council on what the navigation team is doing. And that includes, are you using a racial justice and racial equity toolkit? And every report, the navigation team would say, no, we'll get to that eventually.
Yeah. The navigation teams are basically handed over to SPD.
Yeah.
And that's not a social service organization.
To
state the obvious.
Yeah. And it was a pet project really for Mayor Durkin. And she did not see a need to make them actually do the work that the city council wanted them to do in terms of racial equity. So you can see how, human rights does not factor in to her, idea of how to run the city.
All right. Moving on, more SPD news this week, or the latest SPD news this week.
Interim Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz announced this week set up a new unit within the Seattle Police Department. Now, this comes at a time when the City Council is looking at the units within the Seattle Police Department, trying to determine what needs to continue and what should be moved outside of the department and done by civilian staff instead.
There are a lot of units.
Yeah, and here's the new interim Seattle Police Chief saying, I'll just create a new unit. He named the new unit Community Response Group. And apparently this is his response to calls for community-led public safety. When asked by the media what the new group would do, he said it's a unit that's outside of the precinct structure that can roam all over the city to respond to emergencies like protests, for example. Okay. Now, In fact,
a random example.
Yeah, a random example. Yeah, and that was the one he used, right? In fact, that appears to be what the CRG, the Community Response Group, is. It's an anti-protest squad. There is no means for community groups to directly contact the CRG with their concerns or their needs.
Much for the community.
Right.
They're trying to beat up the community. Is this the idea?
Yeah, I think so. Community groups are supposed to contact precinct captains, who can then decide whether or not to contact the community response group if they think it's necessary. Meanwhile, that CRG roams the city in search of demonstrators to gas and shoot with rubber bullets. One of the two lieutenants who is leading the CRG, John Brooks, is the person who's been the incident commander for most of the demonstrations this summer, including the August 16th protest at the Seattle Police Officers Guild headquarters in SoDo. And if you watch videos of that, you'll see an entirely peaceful large group of protesters assaulted by bicycle police, who gassed and again shot them with rubber bullets, hit them with their bicycles for no apparent reason. Now, John Brooks is the one who's developed the overly aggressive SPD response to crowd control, in which the department has violated a court order to refrain from using chemical weapons against people exercising their free speech rights. He's one of the two lieutenants leading the CRG, the quote-unquote community response group.
Now, awesome.
Yeah, now Diaz was not asked and did not answer whether this is a promotion for Brooks, but it appears that the Seattle Police Department and Interim Chief Diaz are doubling down on the SPD's flawed crowd control and use of force tactics, even though all three oversight bodies have condemned those policies and said that the Seattle Police Department needs to change.
And there have been, what, over 100 different complaints to those bodies of violations of, you know, SPD protocol, and a lot of lawsuits.
I believe it's up to 9,000 regarding complaints to the Office of Police Accountability over the demonstrations this summer.
And the lawsuits are going to cost the city a lot of money.
They are, yeah. So that's what our new interim, if you thought our new interim police chief was going to take us in the right direction, this is proof that he is absolutely in the mold of Carmen Best, if not worse.
Yeah, sadly mistaken.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on. A poll out this week from Crosscut.
Yeah, and it got quite a bit of press, actually, and it wasn't all just press in Crosscut. It was, I think, the Seattle Times also ran an article about it as well. The Elway was tasked by Crosscut, the local news website, to do a poll on 2020 policing and protest in King County. There was a whole lot of press about it. They were supposed to poll voters inside the city of Seattle and in greater King County outside of the city of Seattle and compare their attitudes towards this summer's protests and changes to the police department and police reform. Crosscut used the results to write an article saying that quote unquote conservative areas outside of the Seattle city limits are becoming more liberal because a majority of those voters now support police reform. But then they went on to say, but they definitely don't want to defund the police. That was one of the conclusions that was drawn by Crosscut and by other media from this poll. But when you look at the poll, you go in and you dig into the demographics of who answered the questions, you see a major problem with this poll. First of all, the sample size is too small. They questioned 200 voters in the city of Seattle and 200 voters in King County outside of Seattle. Well, we have over 1.3 million registered voters in King County. So 400 people is a very, very tiny sample, about three one-hundredths of a percent.
If you want to draw any conclusions about differences between the city and the rest of the county, you would probably need double that sample.
At least. Yeah. And then there's a little problem with the age of the respondents. in the city of Seattle, 63% of the sample was people over the age of 51. In King County, 58% of the respondents were over the age of 51. In Seattle, I have to say only a little over one-third of the sample were people under the age of 51, and in King County, that number was 41%. Now, the actual age breakdown of people in King County is 37.8% of the population is over 45, a number under 51, right? And 62.2% is under 45 years of age. And the percentage that are 18 to 44, if you, you know, subtract all the little kids out of there, that's almost 41% of the population of King County, okay? And the cutoff here is younger. It's 45, not 51. Now, you can say that the real reason the poll skews older is that older people tend to vote. So when they ask the question, are you a registered voter, a lot of young people say no, and that's it, right? But I think the poll is skewed because not – for that reason, because there are a lot of younger voters. I think the poll is skewed because of how it was conducted. Nearly half of the respondents were reached on a landline instead of a cell phone.
Oops.
Yeah. The vast majority of people under 50 don't have a landline. They only have a cell phone. And I know a number of people over 50, myself included, who don't have a landline.
And me.
Yeah. Yeah. We only have cell phones, you know, or we use Skype like we're using today, right? Now, but even more disturbing was, I think, the trend in ethnicity in this poll. In Seattle, respondents were 81% white or Caucasian, overwhelmingly white or Caucasian. And in King County, outside of Seattle, 72% were white or Caucasian. Now, the most recent demographics I could find for King County are from 2018, and it lists the ethnic breakdown as follows for the entire county. 64.8% identify as white or Caucasian, 15.2% as Asian and Pacific Islander, 8.9% as Latino, 6% as Black, 4.1% as two or more ethnicities, and 0.9% as Native American. So a poll on police reform that interviews 81% white people and only 6% Asian Pacific Islander, you know, probably one-third of their actual demographic in the county, 5% Black, and only 4% Latino, less than half their demographic within the county, is going to be deeply skewed, and who only mostly interviews old people who are older than 51 who have a landline. That's not going to give you good information. That's going to just tell you that's what grandpa thinks, essentially.
And you can argue again that, you know, white people make up a greater percentage of the electorate, but it doesn't explain that entire gap. And a good pollster would design a survey to take into account those kind of biases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Political leaders and political decisions shouldn't only represent voters. They should represent all people who live inside the county, whether or not they vote. And that should be reflected in the demographics. And the pollsters, Elway, should have adjusted for these things, and they didn't even attempt to. And I don't know if that was because Crosscut has a largely older, largely white readership, or if that's just Elway, the way they run their polls. My guess is
generally Elway is considered as one of the better local pollsters, but I'm really surprised at the small sample size and the skewed demographics.
Yeah. And I think the small sample size too can depend on how much the company that is paying for the poll wants to pay for Elway's work. So I think they
may also have wanted to get the poll out by a certain deadline.
Yeah.
And ordered it on short notice. That's possible too.
Yeah, that's possible too. So I think Crosscut bears a lot of responsibility for that. So beware of polls. And whenever you see one that looks may look a little wonky to you, dig into the demographics of who answered the questions and compare them with the demographics of the actual population they were targeting. So
and the sample size, because people tend to read way more into the crosstabs of polls, you know, the demographics and, you know, geographic location and all the rest of that, you know, gender, breaking things down in a way that is not justifiable because the margin of error is just too great to read anything meaningful into it.
Yeah, so you could have one or two people who are just, you know, weird or, you know, they're just messing with the pollsters, and that can really skew the results in polls that have very tiny sample sizes like this.
Yeah, half of local Filipinos, you know, support police reform. Well, if you only ask two, you know, it doesn't mean much.
And only one of them said they do, that, you know, that doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we're going to be getting a lot of polls, a lot more polls than usual between now and the end of the year.
Yep.
So, yeah.
All right. Moving on, we were discussing Mayor Jenny Durbin.
Oh, can I say something brief about police before we get off?
Sure.
Get that? We're in the middle of city council's budget season, and public hearings are coming up for all the different departments of the city. And Mayor Durkin, as we talked about last week, did not propose any cuts to the SPD. And so that's going to be entirely in city council's lap to propose alternatives to that. I would really encourage people to start following that process closely if they care about defunding police or cutting their budget.
Or
trying to enforce basic human rights in public safety.
Council member Teresa Mosqueda is the chair of the budget committee, and she has opened up the beginning of every budget committee meeting to public comments. So, you know, go to the city council's website, check the agenda for the budget committee hearings, and on the day of a budget committee hearing, sign up and give your public testimony. Talk about whether or not you support defunding the police and where you think that money should go.
And it's all online. They're not doing things in person yet, and so you can do it from your home.
Mm-hmm.
And remember to press *6 when it's your turn to talk.
Yes.
That's spoken from experience, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and oftentimes the first hour of these meetings is devoted to public comments. So it's a really rich resource for both sharing your viewpoints and finding out little tidbits from others.
And hearing from other people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we were previously discussing Mayor Jenny Durkin, and the Washington State Supreme Court had a ruling.
Yes, they did. The Supreme Court overturned a lower court ruling this week and ruled unanimously that the recall petition for Mayor Durkin should not go forward. And the reason it should not go forward is they said that the violations of office that the recall petition cited were not of sufficient gravity to warrant a recall election. So, unless there's any way to appeal that ruling, which there really isn't, it's a state Supreme Court ruling, and it was unanimous, it looks like the recall effort for Mayor Jenny Durkin is dead at this point. Of course, she's up for re-election next year, and as soon as this election on November 3rd passes, you'll start to see, I think, other people filing and raising money to try and challenge her. You really can't raise money, and you really can't file to challenge her before the current election cycle, which will start on November 4th. So that is coming up as well. But there will be no – and the precedent that sets of not allowing a recall petition to go forward if there isn't sufficient violation of your duties as an elected official – probably will impact the recall effort for Shama Sawant as well, because a lot of the things that they cite also are not don't really rise to the level of, say, criminality or breach of public trust.
Yeah. Now the Supreme Court hasn't said why they found the evidence insufficient. They have yet to issue their ruling. So in the coming weeks, we'll see what they just issued the order. They didn't issue the ruling. So we'll see what they say in their ruling and how that sets the bar in terms of evidence that's required for a recall petition. Now, I think that's also perhaps why the Human Rights Commission sent their letter asking the city council to remove Mayor Durkan from office. And we'll see if people start contacting the city council and speaking at the beginning of city council hearings saying, are you going to take action? Are you going to take action? Because clearly Mayor Durkan's not going to resign.
Yeah, not on her own.
No.
All right. Before we dive into the this week's election analysis, did you want to talk about the governor's debate?
Or did you sure. We on the same night that we had the vice presidential debate, so most people were probably watching that. We also had a debate between Jay Inslee, who is the incumbent Democratic nominee, and Lauren Culp, who is the grossly underqualified Republican nominee. He's the police chief of Republic, which is a town of about 1,000 people that is the county seat of very sparsely populated Ferry County. And the reason he got the Republican nominee is he had the backing of gun rights groups. And so that got him a plurality in a very crowded field.
Wasn't he one of the police chiefs in Eastern Washington who refused to carry out new gun control measures that were passed by the state legislature in recent years?
Yes, and that was why he had the backing of the mm-hmm. guns rights groups.
Yeah.
And that came up in the debate on Wednesday night. And he also parroted a number of the sort of the conspiracy theory type things that that the alt-right has been pushing online in support of Donald Trump. For example, he has a very open mind about whether all the fires this fire season were set by Antifa gangs. Newsflash, they weren't. And in fact, you had
Antifa may be a powerful voice, but they can't they can't control lightning strikes.
Yes, and you had
if only
that conspiracy theory, that particular one, originated in Oregon, and you had the FBI, the governor's office, all various sheriff's offices, all saying. Nope, not true, not true. Please don't believe that. And in fact, you had, somebody was circulating what looked like I think it was Jackson County in Southern Oregon, a sheriff's press release saying we arrested all these Antifa people. That was a fake thing that probably came out of Russia, but may have been homegrown, who knows. And here you have a Republican nominee for governor parroting that. It's directly quite disturbing. And
which means that he has major backing from the state Republican Party. Anyone who runs for governor under the Republican banner and survives the primary is going to have backing of the state Republican Party. So this shows you just what crazies we have here in Washington State.
Yeah, the statewide Republican Party has really gone off the deep end along with the National Republican Party in recent years. And, he was also refusing to say what kind of budget cuts he would make, in response to COVID. He expressed skepticism about masks and said that if he were handling COVID, in contrast to Jay Inslee, not only would he not mandate mask orders, he would not even recommend it, which tells you that he is not interested in the science of battling the pandemic, and that also is highly disturbing.
We've seen some statistics too that says Washington State has had fewer deaths than most of the other states in the United States, even though COVID-19 outbreaks were here before they were in most other parts of the country. So I think that kind of advice from the leading Republican candidate in the governor's race is really indicative of the bankruptcy of the Republican Party here.
It is. And, Jay Inslee is not a particularly exciting governor, but he is competent, and that alone is probably going to get him a third term.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there apparently there is an election coming up.
Yeah, that rumor has it. Yep.
Yeah.
And in fact, we get ballots toward the end of the next week. So it's time.
Yeah, people are already getting their voters' pamphlets. I got mine in the mail, at least the state voters' pamphlet. I think the local voters' pamphlet from King County you'll probably get early next week.
Yeah. And, you know, other states, I think something like 5 million people have already voted nationally. So early voting is underway in a lot of the country. And, it's finally time.
So yeah, the election is Tuesday, November 3rd. Just a few little quick facts. All voters' pamphlets are going to be mailed out, by the 14th.
Yeah.
The 13th.
And they're available online also.
And, all ballots will be mailed out by Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. Ballot drop boxes will be open the next day on October 15th. And, you can still register to vote online until October 26th. And online, the address is olvr.votewa.gov. Or you can call 1-800-448-4881 to request a paper registration form.
Yeah, and you can Google it. It comes right up.
Yeah, or on November 3rd, you can go down to your King County Elections Office, listed in the back of your voter's pamphlet, and you can register to vote in person. But I wouldn't leave it that late.
No.
So
and I would highly recommend, and we'll get into this next week, I think, not using the mail to return your ballots since it's a little dicey this year. King County has done a really good job of expanding the number of drop boxes that are available around the county.
Yeah, and you can see a map of them online at the King County Elections website. So vote early, drop your ballot into a ballot drop box, or if you want to rely on the mail, make sure you mail it early.
Yeah.
And then once you've voted, track your ballot. There's a little tear-off strip on your ballot. Definitely tear that off and then keep it. And you can go to the King County Elections homepage and click on Track My Ballot, and you can see when it's received and when it's been counted. And that's very important for everyone to do, because you can also see if there's a question about your ballot or if it's been questioned. So I would encourage everyone to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to start with the federal government this week, and then next week we'll talk about statewide offices. Of course, the first item on the list for federal government is president and vice president, and I think folks who listen to our show regularly know that we support Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the pick.
And I have to say, you know, I have a lot of friends.
Mike's going, what? I said, it's a matter, Mike, it's not even an endorsement at this point. It's just a matter of, if you watch politics and you're concerned about competency and you're concerned about having a democracy in 4 years so that you can vote once again, you don't reelect Donald Trump.
I have a number of friends who are highly skeptical of Joe Biden, and I understand that, certainly. His record is that of a corporate centrist. I will give him credit for his platform, for his campaign on several critical issues, was heavily influenced by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and you know, to my mind, moved that in a more progressive direction, particularly climate change, although Biden still supports fracking, and particularly the economy, which is going to be critical about getting us out of the hole that the pandemic has created. Warren heavily influenced that. That being said, he and Harris are running a fairly much a centrist campaign, and I think that that probably recommends them at this point, because we've had 4 years of a president who really only governs one third of the country, and I was only concerned about one third of the country. And even if it weren't for all the toxic the toxicness and the incompetence on his watch, that's a really flawed approach to any public official.
He misgoverns that one third too, because that's the part of the country where the COVID-19 pandemic is raging at its worst.
Yeah, something like 16 of the 23 states with the worst pandemic right now are governed by Republicans, and they're taking their cues from Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And those cues have been really bad, as we've seen with Trump's own infection and the way he really generated a major cluster in D.C. with the outbreak around the White House.
Right, and he's planning another super spreader event.
Today.
Yeah, today. So we'll see how many people get that as well. So anyone who thought that Donald Trump would learn from actually getting COVID-19 has not been following who Donald Trump is and just how extreme his views are. Getting sick is not going to change his mind about anything.
No, and he's still quite sick, by the way, in case anybody had any doubts about that, as are the people around him.
Yeah.
So I think the other concern with Trump, of course, and it's a very realistic concern as far as, you know, in my analysis, is that if he is reelected, I think he will be reelected in 2024. I think there will be only one serious contender on the ballot, failed to the opposition. And you know, for people who want somebody more progressive than either Biden or Harris, you know, the opportunity to do grassroots organizing, to work through the political parties, all the rest of that, that will not happen after a second Trump term, because we will be in a dictatorship. There are already significant elements of that right now. We can see what he wants to do. And, you know,
didn't he just say criticize his own Attorney General William Barr for not going after all the Democrats with criminal charges?
Yeah, he wants to indict Biden. He wants to indict Hillary Clinton. He's still obsessed about that. And
essentially,
of course,
wants to jail all the leaders of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and he wants to jail Obama, which I'm all for being able to prosecute ex-presidents, because once Trump is out of office, you know, I think that's a fine precedent to go by. But you can see where he wants to go with this. And you can see from history in the rest of the world what the playbook is for leaders who are originally elected who want to become autocrats. People like Erdogan, people like Putin, there's Duterte, there's any number of them, all of whom Trump admires. And you know, he's taken many exact same steps that they have taken. He's criticized the media as the enemy of the people. The next step is to clamp down on a free media. He arrests opposition leaders and any dissenters of any kind. That gets clamped down. Social media gets clamped down. He's criticized that. You know, you can just go down the list. This is what he wants to do in a second term. And you will note in his campaign, he has said nothing about what he wants to do in the second term. Because he knows it would be unpalatable to most Americans. And I think he's not going to leave office willingly. The best way to ensure that he does leave office is with an overwhelming Biden victory that makes it clear.
It needs to be a landslide. It really does. Because, so for folks who think that it's...
Because, go ahead. Because if it's a landslide, it makes it much more difficult for him to claim that the vote was rigged. That it was not a reflection of the American people, because he has to not only delegitimize the election, he has to delegitimize all the polls leading up to the election. And I don't think most Americans are going to buy that.
Even
some Trump supporters.
So for folks who are thinking, well, I'm in a safe state, and that means I can vote for the Green Party candidate or a Socialist Party candidate, what would you say to them?
I would say that, number one, we have listeners outside the state. We reach beyond that. But I would say that the greater the overall vote total for Biden, the less of a chance that there's any legitimacy that is accorded to his refusal to leave office. Because I think he will refuse to leave office. I think that's a given at this point.
Yeah.
But let's get through the election first. And you know, the greater a margin for Biden it is, the less of a hassle it's going to be in November and December.
Yeah, and I think it'll put more pressure on the other members of the Republican Party to muscle him out of there. If
partic- uh, if partic- particularly if the Republicans lose the Senate and lose the House again.
Yeah.
Because that is the one thing that can divorce them from Trump is if you know, rats fleeing a sinking ship, right?
Right.
It really does need to be a landslide if we want to preserve our democracy in this country. And that's not a recommendation. It's just an analysis.
Yeah. Okay, so that said, we're going to talk about some of the federal down-ballot races. Here in Washington State, our two senators are not up for re-election, but are all of the members of our 10 districts for the U.S. House of Representatives are. Most of them are Democrats. That didn't used to be the case. Used to be split pretty close to 50-50, but in the state we have a majority of Democrats, and most of those Democrats are not being challenged by a serious challenger. So in District 1, Susan Del Bene up in North King, Snohomish, Skagit, Whatcom counties, she's doing quite well over her Republican challenger, Jeffrey Beeler. District 2 is Everett Bellingham in the San Juan Islands. That's Rick Larson. He's a longtime incumbent Democrat. He'll probably see re-election. District 3, however, that's Southwest Washington, including Vancouver. There's a longtime incumbent Republican there, Jamie Herrera Butler, who has a very serious challenge from Democrat Carolyn Long. And she's a very good choice in that race. And it is possible that she could beat Butler this time around.
Yeah, she's polling very close to Butler.
Yeah, so that's a race to watch. In District 4, that's Central Washington, Okanagan, Douglas, Grant, Adams, Franklin, and Yakima counties. That includes the Tri-Cities in Pasco, Kennewick, and Richland on the Columbia River. That's a longtime stronghold for Republicans, and the current incumbent there, Dan Newhouse, has been in office for quite some time. He's unlikely to be unseated by his Democratic challenger, Douglas McKinley.
That is the reddest district in the state.
Yeah. And that is a state that includes District 5. That's Eastern Washington, including Spokane, with the noxious Republican Kathy McMorris Rogers is running for re-election there against Democrat Dave Wilson. Wilson is a very good pick in that district, and it would be great if Spokane could turn blue and elect a Democrat, but I don't know if that's going to happen this time.
Probably not, although it is getting bluer over the years.
Yeah.
Spokane is a Democratic stronghold, and that district also includes Pullman in Washington State, which Whitman County tends to vote Democratic.
Yeah.
So it's possible. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, though.
Yeah, we'll see. And then the other districts are primarily Democrats. So you've got strong incumbent Democrats in District 6. That's the Olympic Peninsula with Democrat Derek Kilmer. District 7 is Seattle and Vashon Island, except for Southeast Seattle. That's our very own progressive Democrat, Premila Jayapal. She's up for re-election. District 8 is Eastern King and Pierce counties, plus Chelan and Kittitas counties. That one used to be a Republican stronghold and very recently elected Democrat Kim Schreier.
She's just finishing her first term.
This is her first re-election campaign, so she's got a strong challenger in Republican Jesse Jensen. We'll see if she can hold on to that district for the Democrats. That's one to watch. District 9, Southeast Seattle, Bellevue, Renton, Kent, Federal Way. That's longtime incumbent Adam Smith. He is well ahead of Republican Doug Baszler in that district and will likely see re-election. And then there's District 10, the newest district in the state that was created after the last census in 2010. That's Western Pierce County and most of Thurston County, including our state capital in Olympia. Two Democrats are duking it out in this new district. Denny Heck is retiring from the U.S. House of Representatives to run for lieutenant governor this year. So that threw the race open to two new Democrats. Marilyn Strickland is the former mayor of Tacoma, who represents largely mainstream, socially liberal, but fiscally conservative Democrats.
Yeah. And after she left her position as the mayor of Tacoma, she ran the Downtown Seattle Association, I believe.
Yeah. So Beth Doglio is the progressive choice in that race. She's been garnering endorsements from people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Premila Jayapal, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, and a host of unions, including the Washington State Labor Council and the Washington Education Association. So in that district, the progressive pick is Beth Doglio in District 10 to go to Washington, D.C. So federal races here in the state of Washington.
Okay. We've got under 15 minutes left. Did you want to touch on some of the ballots or leave that for next week?
Why don't we talk about the court positions? We've only got about four of those to do. We can knock those off the list. There are four state Supreme Court justices up for reelection. Two of them are unopposed, Charles Johnson and Deborah Stevens, but two of them have challengers, and those are the two that were recently appointed by Governor Inslee to replace justices who are retiring. Position three, incumbent Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis was this year appointed to replace Mary Fairhurst, who retired. She's being challenged by Dave Larson, a federal way judge who's taken campaign money from state Republican Party members and party affiliates like the Skagit County GOP. Montoya Lewis is the progressive choice in this race. Interestingly, she's a former chief judge for the Nooksack and Upper Skagit Indian tribes, so it's long overdue for them to have some representation on our state Supreme Court. Thank you, Governor Inslee, for appointing her, and she deserves second by the voters this election season. And then
I agree.
Yeah, and then in position six, Justice G. Helen Whitner was appointed in April of this year to replace Charles Wiggins on his retirement. She's fending off a challenge by Richard Cerns, who weirdly appears to have almost no court experience at all. I think that's because she's a black woman, so any white guy then thinks he deserves the job, whether he has any experience or not.
And I believe she is the first African-American woman to be on the state Supreme Court.
She's a former Pierce County Superior Court judge and a very good pick for the Washington Supreme Court, which has been all white in recent years, except for Mary Yu. So long overdue there. And there are a couple of other unopposed judicial races in King County, but there are two that are contested. For King County Superior Court Judge Position 13, it's a very difficult decision here between Hillary Madsen and Andrea Robertson. Both look really good, but I think Madsen is the outstanding choice with her work in juvenile justice and with immigration rights advocates. But
that is an open seat, and she's been endorsed by the incumbent as well.
Yeah. And then position 30 on the King County Superior Court, in a race between Doug North and Carolyn Ladd, the progressive in that race is Carolyn Ladd. So,
yeah, Doug North has a reputation as something of a hard-ass judge.
Yeah.
You know, when we have contested judicial positions on the ballot, I tend to ask a few lawyer friends that I know what their experiences with people are, and they don't have good things to say about North.
Who in this race is the lock 'em up, throw away the key guy? That's Doug North.
Yeah.
Carolyn Ladd is very serious about judicial reform and making sure that everyone is represented fairly. So
she uses the word inclusive a lot in her campaign material, and that tells me something.
Tells you a lot about Doug North.
Yes, that too.
Okay, so those are the judicial.
And we will get through all the state races and the various legislative representatives and all that next week. So
and
ballot measures, yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right.
So vote early.
Moving on, sort of. I heard Wednesday evening was the vice presidential candidate debate, and boy, did I hear a lot of yelling from people.
From your neighbors?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly the 2 minutes where there was a fly on Mike Pence's head. That fly is famous. it was the most interesting race. If it hadn't been for the debate the previous week between Biden and Trump, Pence would have been the rudest of any presidential debate participant in history. He interrupted Harris's answers, I believe, a total of 16 times, roughly one per answer. But Harris, he and Harris both dodged questions, but Pence did it routinely, pivoting instead to various talking points for his ticket. We didn't learn a lot about the two candidates, and I don't think the debate moved the needle very much. It certainly, if anything, once again, the vaunted suburban women that the Democrats are trying to hold on for 2018, if they weren't alienated by Trump's performance, they certainly were alienated by Pence's. And, people of color also noted that the white guy was interrupting the woman of color repeatedly. It was very condescending. And that, more than the actual content of the debate, I think was the takeaway. It didn't move the needle, and to the extent it did move the needle, it was in favor of Kamala Harris, because she appeared potentially presidential.
Yeah, and now I think
that I think was the major question for her.
Yeah, now I think, first off, there aren't that many undecided voters at this point.
No.
Secondly, I think people don't watch the debates to get tips on the candidates' policy priorities. They go to their websites for that. So what they do watch the debates for is character, and they want to see who is a trustworthy person. And my overall experience watching this debate, and I tried to watch it from that perspective as well as to hear whether or not they would answer specific key questions for me. My impression is that Kamala Harris came across as very warm, very real, and extremely competent person, whereas Pence came across as a smooth liar. And it really confirmed for me, okay, here's why this person has stuck by Trump's side for 4 years, is because he is a liar as well, Donald Trump.
It was impossible to try and keep up with the fact-checking.
One of the key questions that they asked towards the end of the debate was, what would you do if Donald Trump refuses to leave office? And Pence actually did respond to that question, although they said he didn't. It was just towards the end, and I'm just finding the quote here, where he said, when we have a free and fair election, we'll have confidence in it. That was his direct quote. So what he's saying with those words is, Trump and I are going to do our best to make sure to try to make sure that everybody believes it's not a free and fair election so we can stay in power.
Yeah, exactly.
That was his answer.
And Harris did not answer the question, which is very smart, actually, because they need to keep their powder dry at this point.
Yeah, she just said, go vote. And actually, she answered the question, too. When she said, go vote, what she said is what we're saying, is that if there's a landslide, there'll be no question, that he'll have to leave. And that was her answer, essentially. So she did answer
the
question.
And it's really sad, honestly, that we're having to take this scenario seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to take Trump at his word. And I keep going back to what Michael Cohen was saying early on this summer, that there is no way Trump will willingly leave office. He just doesn't have the mental capacity to do it.
Yeah. So my feeling about the debate is that she wiped the floor with him. that was my overall impression. And I was trying to watch it from the perspective of, say, a woman my age who doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to politics necessarily. I felt like, wow, this woman is great. She just wiped the floor with this guy who's came across as sleazy and a liar.
And so the average listener is wondering now, what is your age? Never mind. That is a question we will gloss over.
On all the key things that voters care about right now, which is the pandemic and the economy, Harris came across as the better candidate.
Yeah, she was much more trustworthy.
Yeah, she addressed questions directly, whereas Pence talked as if Paige was not even in the room and had not even asked him a question.
He would simply not answer the question and pivot to a talking point.
And for me as a woman, that's just classical mansplaining and kind of classical cluelessness and sexism.
And racism on top of it.
Exactly.
So there was all that, and you know, Harrison needed basically to not lose voters in that debate because they're well ahead right now in the polls.
Yeah.
And she did that, so she won the debate because she accomplished her mission. Pence needed to lure back voters who maybe voted for Trump in 2016 and are not so sure now. He failed to do that, I think. So I think in that sense, Harris came out the winner. And who knows if we'll have any other debates this year too.
Yeah. The next one has been canceled.
The next one has been canceled because Donald Trump wouldn't do it, over Zoom or, you know, online because he's afraid to acknowledge that he poses any kind of a COVID risk. So the debate was basically canceled because of his ego. And we're seeing that play out this week, too, where absolutely nothing he says can be trustworthy. And clearly he is still fairly ill. So I think the fact that he's holding indoor and outdoor events this weekend is incredibly irresponsible.
Yeah, just a reminder from the CDC, the recommendation is if you've had a serious case of COVID-19, if it has moved to your lungs as it has with Donald Trump, and he admitted that this week, then you can and should assume that you are contagious for up to 20 days after you are first diagnosed with the illness. And it has not been 20 days.
Yeah. No matter how long they sat on it. Yeah. There's a lot of evidence that that he knew he was positive, even
at least a couple days before. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're hosting another super spreader event even as we speak. So that's pretty terrible. Yeah, and I don't think that's going to help him with polls.
No. Yeah. And he's particularly losing in the polls among seniors, which were really part of his base in 2016. And it's specifically his handling of COVID that has alienated them since, you know, they tend to be much more susceptible. And so he's going to Florida to host a super spreader event, which is the highest percentage of senior voters in the country. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make a lot of sense except for Donald Trump.
Yeah, that and the fact that he was hit pretty deeply during the vice presidential debate when Susan Page said, hey, you know, you guys have had 4 years to come up with a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, and we haven't seen anything yet. What is the plan? And both Trump and Pence have now refused to answer that question. I think seniors are very concerned about what's going to replace the Affordable Care Act.
And they should, because, you know, the Senate is still hell-bent on confirming Amy Coney Barrett before the election. I don't think she's going to be able to help Trump with the election. If she has any integrity, she will refuse to help Trump with any election appeal. But
I doubt that's going
to
happen.
But again, that's why we need a landslide, so it doesn't get to that point.
Yeah.
And to be clear, you know, I talked earlier about the sort of game plan that would-be dictators use to destroy democracy and stay in power. And one of the things that they attack is an independent judiciary. We saw that again this morning with a Trump appointee being the deciding vote in overturning a lower court ruling and allowing the state of Ohio to limit drop boxes to one per county. Ohio has three counties with more than a million people in them, Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. So that's going to affect a state that it could potentially be a swing state. Another federal judge overturned ruling the same way that Governor Abbott did there a couple weeks ago. So unless it goes to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court upholds the Ohio ruling, Texas at least will have multiple drop boxes. Texas has six counties with more than a million people. It has a number of metro areas with a lot of people in it. So, you know, it's going to be, They're trying to do game the system. And if you look at the history of losing democracies, everything that those dictators do is legal because they have rigged the judiciary. And that's what we're seeing now with the Department of Justice, and that's why we're seeing all the court appointees in the Senate, and now we're seeing that with a new Supreme Court appointee, and the hearings for that will start this coming week, too.
Yeah.
A lot going on.